That's the mixtape coming up at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
Live from Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is The Local Edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Well, coming up now that President Trump's federal budget package is the law of the land, we continue our look at how the impacts of that legislation will affect local residents, especially when it comes to Medicaid recipients. Patricio Robayo talks to Dr. Duncan Ryan Mann, who specializes in public finance and health economics. That story's coming right up. Meanwhile, Republican Congressman Mike Lawler is breaking with the Trump administration on issue-related immigration. But first up, we start with another question we've been asking for weeks now, which is, will New York's lawmakers return to Albany? And this week, that question now has become that the big, beautiful bill is the law of the land. Now that lawmakers know how much of a hole it will leave in New York's budget, the budget that was just passed last month, will they return to Albany? Democrats who control the state legislature and Governor Kathy Hochul have been sharply critical of the new federal budget package signed by President Trump. They warn the tax breaks and program cuts that it contains will decimate New York's own budgeting, given the substantial changes of social services and other impacts. But Governor Hochul says it's still too soon to call a special session, estimating the state is likely facing a $750 million shortfall. Hochul spoke with reporters in Albany today.
Let's look at our agencies. Let's look at our efficiencies. I mean, what savings can we find to try to address that shortfall? And the other changes, because of the little longer runway for the changes to take effect, we have next year's budget to take a hard look. But listen, I'm ready to have the conversations, but I'm just going to be not saying right now whether I think a special session is necessary, because I don't have the clear picture.
And in other news, Hudson Valley Congressman Mike Lawler is breaking with the Trump administration in advising Haitian immigrants in his district to seek asylum before their status changes. Jesse King has more.
Lawler, a Republican from the 17th District, is also calling on the federal government to extend temporary protected status for Haitians. The Trump administration is currently dismantling some long-running TPS programs, which allow refugees from certain countries to legally stay in the United States as part of its broader efforts to ramp up deportations nationwide. The Department of Homeland Security says political tensions in Haiti have calmed enough since the assassination of the Haitian president in 2021. Speaking from Spring Valley's First Timothy Christian Church Thursday, Lawler says he disagrees.
The challenges on the ground in Haiti are immense, and they are serious. It has devolved into a full-blown crisis and a government that is unstable and beholden to gangs and others engaged in illicit conduct, including gang activity, kidnapping, drug trafficking, human trafficking, gun trafficking.
Lawler notes the U.S. Department of State currently warns Americans against traveling to Haiti and has urged Americans there to return home. Lawler, who has sided with his fellow Republicans on some immigration initiatives, including those in Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, says he agrees with the federal government in that some countries have, quote, abused the TPS designation, but he doesn't believe Haiti is one of them. The Rockland County village of Spring Valley is home to a large Haitian diaspora. This week, a Spring Valley High School student was released from Immigration and Customs Enforcement after more than a month of detention. Lawler says 20-year-old Allen Jr. Pierre was in the country legally on parole after crossing the U.S.-Mexico border. He was arrested by ICE while attending an immigration hearing in New York City last month. Lawler says his office coordinated with the Department of Homeland Security to facilitate his release.
He is here under the parole system, and he went in accordance with what was asked of him, what was required, to go get his biometrics done, and was subsequently detained. It was wrong. It should not have happened. And so I personally called Secretary Noem's office, and within 36 hours, he was released.
Amen.
It shouldn't take that.
Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer's office was also involved in the discussions. Brendan Logan Charles, deputy supervisor of the town of Ramapo, says much of the local Haitian community is on edge amid the rise in deportations.
I have a Haitian grandson. When you speak to your 11-year-old grandson and he asked me, Nana, am I okay to go to school?
Wow.
Are they going to take me in school? Are they going to take his other grandparents? I have to reassure him. Don't worry. Nana got you. I'll make a phone call. I'll call the congressman.
Lawler says he agrees with some of the government's efforts to deport those who are in the country illegally, but he says those who are legally going through the immigration system should be allowed to see their cases through. Part of the problem, he says, is that the system is overwhelmed. At multiple points Thursday, Lawler voiced his support for the Dignity Act, a bipartisan immigration bill that has been in Congress since 2023. Nathaniel Demosthenes, pastor of the First Timothy Christian Church, says he'd like to see Haitian refugees treated similarly to those from Ukraine.
To say that, are we walking on eggshells? I think we've been walking on eggshells since before Mike was born. Okay, and that's what is established here. We need a reform, and we need an immigration bill solution that is commensurate with the great history of this nation. What we did in Ellis Island is what we need to do now again.
Asked whether it would consider Lawler's call to extend TPS, the Department of Homeland Security pointed WAMC to its original decision to let the designation expire. TPS status for Haiti is set to expire August 3rd, with participants expected to leave by September 2nd. In Poughkeepsie, I'm Jesse King for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you to the New York Public News Network for that reporting.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Public radio is available to everyone for free, but we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters right now. Thanks.
Give now at wjffradio.org.
It's WJFFradio.org. You can also call us, 845-482-4141. That's 845-482-4141. Make your donation over the phone. Please do it now and do it in support of great local news here on Radio Catskill. News and information you can't get anywhere else on programs like The Local Edition and Radio Chatskill. It's important work, but it can't be done without your support. So please give what you can now. Help us out with our summer fun drive. Donate now, 845-482-4141. Go to WJFFradio.org. This is a local edition. I'm Jason Dole. And as healthcare policy continues to dominate headlines, many Americans are left wondering how recent federal decisions will affect their access to care. With the signing into law of what was dubbed the Big Beautiful Bill, major cuts to Medicaid are now set to take effect, raising serious questions about the impact on hospitals, families, and communities across the country. To help us understand what this means, Radio Catskill's Patricio Rubio spoke to Dr. Duncan Ryan Mann, a professor in the School of Business at Empire State University. Dr. Ryan Mann specializes in public finance and health economics, and he's here to break down the real-world consequences of these sweeping changes.
There are several that relate to Medicaid, and there are some that are outside of Medicaid but affect people that don't have Medicaid but purchase insurance through the health insurance marketplace. So starting with Medicaid, probably the biggest pieces are the work requirement that a number of states already have in place. Arkansas was the first state back in 2018 that implemented work requirements for Medicaid-eligible people. Today, I think there are about 10 states that do it. It's been shown to reduce Medicaid enrollments. In Arkansas, there were about 18 or 20,000 individuals who dropped out of Medicaid because of the work requirement. So that's one big piece. Another piece is just paperwork. The legislation requires that individuals validate or verify that they're eligible for Medicaid twice a year rather than once a year. May not seem like a huge burden, but it's another hoop to jump through, and it's gonna discourage people from seeking Medicaid coverage. Those are probably the two biggest pieces. The part that I mentioned in addition is that for people that have incomes a little bit above or even substantially above the Medicaid cutoff, which for a family of four in New York State is about $44,000. So if you have less than $44,000 in family income for a family of four, you're eligible for Medicaid. If you are above that threshold, you have to either get insurance coverage through your employer or purchase insurance through what are referred to as the health insurance exchanges or health insurance marketplace that were created by the Affordable Care Act. Now, those health care policies that are purchased through those marketplaces have significant subsidies. So the federal government provides subsidies for people all the way up to four times the poverty level. So for a family of four, that's up to about $120,000. People can receive subsidies through these health insurance marketplaces. Those subsidies are going to be substantially reduced as a result of this legislation. So that means that the premiums that people pay for health insurance through the health insurance exchanges is going to increase by a substantial amount. It's on the order of $200-$400 a month for couples and families. So that's really that's a significant chunk of money. You're talking a couple of thousand to many thousands of dollars a year in additional health insurance cost. That's going to discourage people from getting coverage. So we're going to have a lot more uninsured. Estimates are that just in New York State, there are likely to be about 1.5 million more people who will not be insured. That means there'll be people who will be dropped off of Medicaid and people who will not purchase private health insurance through the health insurance exchanges or marketplace. So that's a lot of people. That's a good chunk of the population, that 1.5 million people just in New York State. Nationwide, it's in the neighborhood of their estimates that range between 15 and 20 million people nationwide could well lose insurance coverage, either because of dropping out of Medicaid or just being discouraged from purchasing private health insurance because the cost has gone up due to the reduction in subsidies that used to be there as a part of the Affordable Care Act, but this legislation is reducing substantially.
Yeah, it's just amazing when you tell me those numbers, it's overwhelming. So we talked about it a little bit here, but let's talk more about how these cuts will impact low income families in New York State. What are the immediate ramifications of this bill?
People that are on Medicaid through no choice of their own. These are people that have very low incomes. Most of the families have children, and children make up a large part of the Medicaid population. So Medicaid pays for health care for people who otherwise would not be able to afford it. Prior to the Affordable Care Act, there were over 40 million people nationwide who were uninsured. Today, that number has been cut by more than half. So there are fewer than 20 million people now nationwide who are uninsured, which is wonderful, which is good. I mean, it's still not great, but it's way better than it was back 15 years ago. But as these cuts go into place, we are going to have another increase in the uninsured population. That means that people will not be able to go to the doctor for basic health care. If they do go to, the emergency room, they will end up with a bill from the hospital or the provider that they may or may not be able to pay. That's going to have an impact on hospitals in particular, who are anticipating very significant reductions in revenue due to the changes in Medicaid and the increased number of uninsured in the population. So, right. So it's going to really affect, there's very high likelihood that a number of rural hospitals in particular will end up going belly up, just won't have enough revenue to meet the costs that they need to cover the cost of providing care in their communities. And that's really problematic. In a rural area, you may have to drive 20, maybe 50 miles if a hospital closes just to get basic care. It has impact on accidents. If there's an emergency, a ambulance may have to drive, you know, twice as far to get a person to a hospital if the closest rural hospital has closed. So that can be really a problem for people's health, welfare, and not to mention the cost of getting that care.
And you talk about the rural hospitals, you know, maybe going belly up or, you know, cutting costs. Here locally, we're in Sullivan County, and Garnet Health had just recently announced, I think maybe a day or two before the actual signing of the bill, that they are doing layoffs and cutting some services just because of the reduction of federal funding to these hospitals. And in the past couple of years, I would say that the hospital has been cutting services, sending people over to Orange County, its county over, for some services. Like, even like for me, I have a child. I live in Sullivan County, but there is no pediatric emergency room. The nearest one is in Orange County, which thankfully for me is not too far away. But for other people in the county, other folks further up in the county, that's a long head to Orange County.
Definitely is. I don't know the counties that well in New York, but is your county part of District 18, who's represented by Pat Ryan in Congress?
No, we're District 19, okay. Josh Riley.
Okay. So actually, the New York State Department of Health has done a district-by-district analysis of the likely impacts of this legislation. And in District 19, Josh Riley's district, they're likely to be an additional 37,000 uninsured individuals in your district. The impact on hospitals in your district is likely to be a negative $48 million on the, you know, in total across all the hospitals in your district. So that's a significant chunk of money. I don't know how many hospitals there are in your district, but even if there are, you know, a dozen, that's going to mean that each hospital is going to be losing $4 or $5 million in revenue, which is going to have a real significant impact on the ability of these organizations to provide the services that they have historically done.
The past couple of years, it has been a struggle with the hospital, say, as cutting services or really reeling from the pandemic, because the pandemic really put a strain on hospitals, especially rural hospitals, especially in the beginning with the influx of patients and then dealing with the funding.
Yeah, no, truly. Yeah, I mean, hospitals have just barely recovered from the pandemic, and this is going to be a really significant impact on, particularly on their revenues.
This is a Local Edition. You're listening to Patricio Romayo speaking to Dr. Duncan Ryan-Mann, a professor in the School of Business at Empire State University who specializes in public finance and health economics, talking about the potential impact of Medicaid recipients in New York State now that President Trump's spending and budget package is law. We're going to return to this conversation in just a moment, but we're going to pause now to ask you for your support for this radio station and specifically for local news. When you get a moment, please go to WJFFradio.org to make your donation to support what we do here, or call 845-482-4141. That's 845-482-4141. We do need your help. Now it's our summer fun drive. And just listening to this story, if you're into it, you're listening to it, you're sticking around for the second half of it, just think about what we're talking about here. It's what we've been talking about for quite a while, especially since January. We've been talking about just potential local impacts of what's happening in Washington, D.C. But this week in particular, now that the big bill was signed into law, there's many questions of like, okay, what happens next? We have a much better idea of what's going to happen. People were worried about what might be in it. Now we know what was in it. And now it's a matter of saying, okay, well, how do we deal to these changes in domestic policy, social services? How is this going to impact people? If this radio station wasn't here, you might still be listening to NPR. You might still hear about what's happening in Washington, D.C. Maybe you'll hear about what's happening at the state level, if you're lucky, with your state when you're listening to national news. But with this radio station here, we get to connect what's happening in our country to what's happening just down the road from you. What's happening to you and your neighbors, and why? And who's responding? Who feels one way about it? Who feels another way about it? And what might happen next? That's the type of information that we're bringing you. Those are the types of conversations that we're having. That's why it's crucial to have public radio here in the Catskills, Northeast Pennsylvania. Wherever you're listening to Radio Catskill, we need you to stand with us now. Because we are under threat financially. That's one of the other changes that's happening in Washington, D.C. That's one of the other policies that's been pushed there. The Senate right now has before it a rescissions package that may take away the funding that was already approved for public radio and television stations across this country. The funding that was already approved might go away if the Senate decides, yeah, that's what we want to do. And they're looking at that here at the same time that our fund drive happens. Our fund drive ends next Friday, a week from today. The Senate has until next Friday, a week from today, to decide what they're going to do. Whatever they do, we still need your help. We need it more than ever. If they are successful, if they pass this rescissions package, if they take this funding away, we're really going to need everybody to step up and give literally 25% more, because that's how much of our budget we're going to lose. But if we don't lose our budget, if we don't lose that funding, we don't lose that quarter of our budget, we don't know what's going to happen next. But we do know we need to continue doing this good work here, and we're going to need your support in that instance too. So no matter what happens, we need to hear from you. Decide what you can give, and please support the good work that we do here on the Local Edition, on local news programs like Radio Catskill. We bring you daily news twice a day here on Radio Catskill, daily local news, and it's an amazing thing. I want you to be part of it. Give now. Go to WJFFradio.org or call 845-482-4141. Let's go back to Patricio talking to Dr. Duncan Ryan Mann.
What is the federal game plan here in doing these cuts to Medicaid? Like, what is their vision of healthcare? You know, the reasoning behind it?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, the logic is to maintain the tax cuts that Trump wanted to keep in place, the $3-point-something trillion in tax cuts. It's $4-point-something trillion in tax cuts that he wanted to retain, that would go away if this bill didn't go through. That would go away starting in 2026, in 5 or 6 months. So to keep them in place and not completely bust the federal deficit and the federal budget, they came up with $1 trillion in cuts in spending, all through Medicaid. So that's balancing off some of the reduction in taxes, that about a quarter maybe of the reduction in taxes are being offset by this reduction in spending for Medicaid. The logic is that it's one of the biggest programs that the federal government runs that can be cut. Medicare, I think, was viewed as completely off limits. Cutting Medicare, you know, $1 trillion in Medicare cuts would have resulted in seniors, you know, having a major uprising, and anyone who voted for it would probably not be reelected. So Medicaid, I think, was viewed as a program that some people don't like, thinking that it's for people that can't afford to buy something on their own. So why does the federal government provide it? You know, we are the only developed country in the world that doesn't have some form of universal health coverage. So if you look at every other country in Western Europe, Canada, Japan, Australia, you name it, every one of those countries has universal coverage of some sort or another. They do not have 15, 20 million people who are uninsured. They just don't have that. And yet they spend way less than we do. We spend, if you
divided up on a per capita basis, we spend over $13,000 per person on healthcare in this country. That's just an astronomical amount. I mean, think about it. $13,000. If you have that in your pocket, that's a huge chunk of money. So, and it amounts to close to 17% of our GDP, of the total country's total output, is devoted to healthcare. That's more than twice what most Western developed countries spend. So again, if you take Canada, Australia, Japan, Germany, France, Britain, et cetera, whatever kind of system they have, they spend on the order of half of what we spend. And at the same time, they have health outcomes. In other words, longevity, life expectancy, maternal mortality, child or infant mortality. We are at the very bottom of the quality list, you know, of the quality of those health outcomes. Our maternal mortality rates are twice what most Western countries are. And it's due to the fact that we have so many uninsured people. We have so many people who have relatively poor health insurance. Even if they have health insurance, they have a policy that's sort of a bare bones policy. That's what's referred to as a high deductible policy. So they don't actually start getting insurance until they've spent, you know, $5,000, $8,000, maybe more per year until their health insurance coverage actually kicks in. So those high deductible policies really discourage people from getting care, even if they need it, even if they're sick, even if a woman needs prenatal care, she may be discouraged from getting it because she just can't afford it on an out-of-pocket basis until that insurance coverage kicks in. So we have very poor access to health care because of the financial constraints.
So what options do we have for state, local governments, communities to either offset the loss of these cuts or to just prepare for these cuts?
Yeah, I think hospitals are probably doing the best that they can, but at this point, they're probably just figuring out contingency plans for what services are they going to need to cut? How can they pare down their expenses to match the reduction in expenditure in revenue that they're likely to experience? I don't think it's only been a couple of months, I think, that people really realized or tend to believe or see that that legislation was really going to come. Was really going to come to fruition. I don't think a lot of people thought that it was going to actually materialize back 6 months ago or 3 months ago. So we're still very much, I think, in shock, and the preparation is going to have to be a bit hectic. I mean, one maybe good or bad feature of the legislation is that not all of the elements of the legislation kick in immediately. In fact, the Medicaid cuts are not likely to be fully felt until 2027. So for about a year and a half, most of the Medicaid changes don't go into effect till 2027. That was intended, I think, for a couple of things. One is the states to set up work requirement verification programs is going to take a lot of work at the state and in New York, the county level, to figure out how to verify employment or verify training or verify education for people that do want to retain Medicaid coverage. Another reason I believe is that 2027 is after the midterm elections. So the full impact isn't going to be felt until after those 2026 elections. The things that are going to kick in relatively quickly are the reduction in subsidies for health insurance purchases through the health insurance marketplace. Those are going to be going into effect in January of 2026. So when we have, I think it's around somewhere between 20 and 30 million people go to their marketplace, their state-based place to purchase health insurance, they're going to notice that their subsidies for health insurance have diminished, or they're probably going to realize that the premiums have gone up substantially. So we are going to see some immediate or relatively quick in the next 5 or 6 months impact from this legislation in the form of fewer people who are purchasing health insurance through these
health insurance marketplaces, and we'll have more people who are uninsured. So that's going to be, I think, probably the first big impact of this legislation. We'll have a few million more people who are uninsured as a result of this legislation. You know, again, in your district, that's estimated to be about